Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So I can ramble.
All right, good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and when I'm not here at our studios, you can find me at one of the Epicurean Group restaurants at Dell'Anima, Lartuzzi, Lepicio, and Fora, or our new restaurant, Alta Linea, at the Highline Hotel, where I serve as beverage director for the group. If you like what you hear on In the Drink, you can listen to our past episodes either on iTunes or on www.heritageradionetwork.org, where all of our previous episodes are archived. Excited today. Today we have a great producer of bourbon that we have at pretty much all of our restaurants. We have Trey Zoller, the founder and whiskey maker for Jefferson's Bourbon. I can't tell you how much I really love these bourbons, and I'm excited to have you in the studio today. Welcome.
Thanks a lot. Great to be out here.
At our new restaurant, we at Alta Linea, we have the bourbon that you've recently released on the water. I want you to tell me more about this, because I was excited about it. I love the way it tastes. I love the history of it, or the story behind it. It's something that you actually bring out onto the water. It kind of replicates the way that an old school bourbon might have been made a long time ago when it was actually shipped on the water. But tell us more about how this came to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't think about the history when I first put the product out.
Oh, really? To me, I was like, oh, it must be because of the history.
I wish I was that smart. Yeah. But it really goes to, it's kind of shown me why bourbon proliferated in Kentucky in the first place. But initially, I was lucky enough to go out on my friend's ship for my 40th birthday down in Costa Rica. A friend of mine named Chris Fisher, who is the expedition leader for OSearch, which catches, tags, releases, and gathers data on great white sharks. So we were down in Costa Rica fishing, surfing, sitting on the bow of the deck, as a couple of Kentucky guys would do, drinking bourbon. And as we were drinking the bourbon, I watched the bourbon slosh back and forth in the bottle. And as I thought about it sloshing in the bottle, I thought it certainly would happen in the wood, in a barrel as well. So throughout the night, I was somehow able to convince him to take 5 barrels and put it on his ship. So over the next 3.5 years, he traveled pretty much the world's oceans carrying these 5 barrels. Or at least he did for the first 2.5 years, before I got a call saying that 2 of the barrels, the bands had corroded and burst.
They mysteriously disappeared.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I have my own theory on that. I call it Juan's share instead of the angel's share. Because one of the deckhands named Juan seemed to know more about this bourbon when they finally brought it back to port than anyone else. So what happened, and why I thought that this might be a good idea, is it's sloshing around the barrel. It's accelerating the aging process because it's constantly in contact with the wood. So the more contact with the wood, the more flavors it's picking up, the more color. And the wood actually acts as a filter, stripping out the astringency of the alcohol. So as 3.5 years later, what we did is we initially put new fill bourbon in there. So it went in as clear as water. When we dumped it, didn't know what to expect exactly, but it came out, it was almost black. And it was very thick. It was almost syrupy. We later sent one of the barrels back to the cooperage to have it reverse engineered. And they saw that the sugars caramelized in there like they've never seen before. So as it passed the equator, it picked up, you know, that heat really just baked in those sugars.
Yeah, I know a Kentucky summer is really warm, but I bet nothing compared to a whole year in Costa Rica.
I think it was it went down past the equator. It spent actually went through the Panama Canal 6 times during those 3.5 years. So it really baked down there. And then after the bands supposedly corroded, they took it from the bow of the ship and put it into the boiler room. which is, you know, often 120 degrees down there. So it was really baking. Not only was it baking and sloshing around in the barrel, but it also breathed in the salt air. So it picked up a briny flavor. It picked up a very caramelized, almost dark rum kind of feel to it because of the thickness. And it was a bourbon at heart. So it was almost like three spirits in one when you tasted it, when you got the results of it.
Now, it seems more elegant than the way you're describing when I taste it. Have you blended it down with some other? Or when you buy a bottle of that, is that purely... It's not as like dark and viscous as...
No, so here's what we did. I couldn't replicate it. You know, once that was an experiment the first time we did it, the first voyage. Afterwards, we tried to see how we could do this on a little bit larger scale. So what I started doing was taking bourbon aged 6 to 8 years in Kentucky and putting it on ships and sending it. It hits over 30 ports, crosses the equator 4 times, and hits 5 continents. So we put it in at about 125 proof. By the time it comes back to Kentucky, it's actually somewhere in the 120 proof range, and we cut it down to around 90. In that time, it really picks up those flavors that you described. And it's been called salted caramel popcorn.
I love it. It's one of the most unique bourbons I've ever tasted, and is extraordinarily delicious. Now, can you tell us a little bit about how you got started? I was looking at the Kings County Distillery released a book a few years back, and it has kind of a chart and the lineage of all of the different bourbons. And there's this, you know, most of the bourbon in America, it's all made in America, obviously, is made in Kentucky, and 95% of it just comes from a few kind of small handful of distilleries. And in their chart, I didn't see your bourbon at all. I was kind of surprised not to see it. Can you tell us how you got started and where you kind of fit into the distillery chart that exists in Kentucky?
So I started the business in 1997 and called it McLean and Kine. The McLeans were my mom's side of the family. The Kines, my dad's, that had both been in the bourbon business for generations. Actually, we can trace my mom's side of the family back to 1799. When my 8th-generation grandmother was arrested for moonshining and bootlegging. So growing up in Louisville, you're surrounded by bourbon. It's kind of a way of life. If you went to my grandmother's house, she didn't ask you what you wanted to drink. She asked, how do you take your bourbon? And everything she cooked with, she had bourbon doused with bourbon. So when I left Kentucky, you know, I was looking for better bourbons, and you just couldn't find it outside of the... And I was privy to the fact that bourbon had been on a 30-year decline before I started the business. So there was a built-up inventory of great super-aged bourbons that weren't being offered to the public. It was either being blended in with a younger bourbon, or it was just evaporating off into nothing. So I started, you know, I thought that there was an opportunity to come out, bottle up some of this great whiskey that I had access to, and offer it. So we did that with the Jefferson's Reserve, one recipe, one age, and it was at a time that, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, people weren't drinking bourbon outside of the bourbon belt. I would bring it to friends' parties in D.C. or New York, and it would sit on the bar unopened, which vastly different from today. Now it's the first thing consumed. So not only was I able to buy this great bourbon that we use for Jefferson's Reserve, and I was able to buy younger stocks of that as well, but I was able to pick up different lots of bourbon. Mm-hmm. I'd get offered a 16-year-old bourbon, 500 barrels of it, or 600 barrels of a 14-year-old bourbon. Some great, great whiskey. Not quite enough to start a separate label, but the great offerings. So what I started doing was playing around with them and marrying them or blending them together. And I found that I could get more balance, more complexity by putting these different recipes together. So what I did then and what I continue to do is buy from different large distilleries and manipulate those bourbons in some form or fashion. We now have a distillery that we bought into, Kentucky Artisan Distillery, and they are now distilling about 10% of what we will produce or what's aging right now.
But now, as these large distilleries have seen their own demand increase astronomically in the last decade and a half, how have they been able to assure you that you can still get the supply that you need?
We have contracts. We've got contracts. Okay. And, you know, again, I've been doing it for almost 20 years now. So I've been doing it much longer than bourbon's impossible to get. I get calls weekly from people asking to source bourbon and or how do I get into the bourbon business. But these relationships that I've established over the last 20 years, I'm still able to get people to, you know, we've recently bought some older bourbon, very old bourbon. We released 2 years ago a 30-year-old bourbon. So we're still able to get some older juice, and I've got contracts where we're having new fill made for us. As we now have a distillery, that initially that's what I wanted to do, was build my own distillery. And I learned pretty quickly I'll never be able to do it as consistently or economically as the big guys do. As you said, that lineage, that tree that you referenced earlier, there was really eight distilleries that that really endured over the last 50 years. My dad wrote a book, Bourbon in Kentucky, where he identified over 2,500 distilleries, legal distilleries in Kentucky prior to Prohibition. And those ones that made it, you know, have generations of knowledge and have put hundreds of millions of dollars into R&D. And they've really perfected the science of what bourbon making and distillation is all about. So I kind of looked at it, and I look at it as nature versus nurture. The nature is the distillation. And nurture, and most distillers will say 70 to 80% of what bourbon is comes from the maturation process, where the heart and soul of bourbon comes from once it hits the wood. So I wanted to concentrate my efforts on that nurturing process. So with our Jefferson and Jefferson's Reserve, it's done more as a blendier. So I'm taking four different recipes of different ages and bringing them together to get a certain style or flavor profile. So with our Jefferson's, it's very approachable, very fruity. With our Reserve, again, it's four recipes of older ages, and it's more complex, more sophisticated.
Now, I'd love to try to figure out why I like your bourbon so much. I mean, anyone can buy distillate and blend it, but you know, you're saying that you guys are particularly talented blenders. I have to think that, the actual sourcing of the spirit of the White Dog, I guess it is, when you buy it and it's unaged, that has to be an important part of it. But if you're buying from these super large distillers and it's somewhat of a neutral product at that time, then...
Well, no, that's not necessarily the case. Again, it's different recipes. And what we do is one of the four products that we have is over 50% of the total. So that gives us the consistency. And then we're bringing in these other recipes that are going to have different flavors. So when you have one distillate from one recipe, you're going to have one dominant flavor. By blending or bringing them together, you're able to get flavors throughout. You're able to get big flavors up front, some weight, mid-palate, and then the finish that you're looking for. So, yes, you know, like cognacs or a lot of winemakers have been doing for centuries, it's the blending. A lot of in Scotch, a lot of the whiskey maker is not the distiller, it's the person that's blending it together. So I think with our Jefferson and Jefferson's Reserve, it is the result of blending. Now, we are buying from other distillers, and they make great products, but we're taking those products and adding steps and putting time and effort into it afterwards. We've now got 11 different types of Jeffersons. And still, my most difficult job is the blending aspect and bringing in those four different recipes for Jefferson's or Jefferson's Reserve. You know, it's not a science so much as, you know, we're with the ocean, you know, we're putting on a ship. We've got the route down. So each time we're putting a batch together, it takes a lot of work. And it's still, you know, my dad laughs at me. He looks at me all the time as I'm doing it. He's like, Trey, you look confused. And I am, because it's a difficult process putting that together.
Yeah. And what did your folks do other than your dad writing this book about bourbon?
So
your dad must be really proud that you started this. You know, it sounds like he had a huge bourbon interest. Was he involved in the bourbon industry in any way?
Not until He and I, he actually helped me start it. He was with me for about the first 2 years, and then he went off and did other things and really started writing books on bourbon. So prior to that, he was in telecommunications and an attorney. So he loves it. He's eaten up with bourbon now. His hobby is going to different courthouses, going through the records, and then going out to old distillery sites and trying to find out where they were and what their output was. And it's he really geeks out on it.
That's really cool. Now, you touched on this a little bit earlier, and you said that when you started, you couldn't get people to drink bourbon, and now you can't produce enough of it almost. So we know that there's a huge increase in the demand for bourbon, but what's the why? Why do you think this has happened?
You know, it's almost a perfect storm of a number of different influences that have changed. One, people started offering better bourbons, like ourselves, and a number of people were out there that started looking and doing single bottle bottlings as well as small batch bottlings, so there were better products. Also, when the downturn in the economy came, people started looking for value. And vodka, it was not value in it. It's more expensive to put bourbon in a bottle than any other spirit. We have to buy new barrels. We lose so much to evaporation. Most of our product, we've lost half the yield by the time we put it into the bottle. And certainly the Madman effect was an influence. And then
is that something that bourbon distillers actually speak about, the Madman effect?
I think so. People, wow. It was all of a sudden it was cool. And then certainly with the mixology and the classic cocktails coming back, if you look at classic cocktails, bourbon and rye were mostly the basis. So people started looking back at brown liquors and whiskeys, and American whiskeys specifically. But I think more than all of that, it's your smartphone. There's so much information at the touch of your finger that, as I've referenced vodka earlier, because it was such the dominant spirit prior to, what are you going to learn about vodka? It's 5 times distilled or 6 times distilled. With bourbon, there's so much that goes into it. There's so much of a story in each different brand. And people want that knowledge. And once you gain that knowledge, you get that thirst for it, you want to find out more. And it's really gone from, prior to that, people used to drink one product. They were brand loyal. Now, most people that drink bourbons have a bar full of bourbons, and they've had different ones, and they're proud to tell you about each one and show what's distinct about that. So it's that knowledge and that education that people get. The more they get into it, the more they can identify flavors that they're looking for. And I referenced it, they're able to geek out on it a little bit. And it's kind of sexy, just that information about it.
Great. And just to one last question, we'll go for a break. Would you characterize your bourbons as being in any distinct style?
We have 11 different types of bourbon, so it's hard to wrap them up as a group. Mine, I think, are more flavorful. They're not dominated by one flavor. I would say there's more fruits that come out of the bottle you have in front of you specifically, just an explosion of fruits. And if we're going to take a break, I guess we can talk about that one afterwards.
All right, that's a great segue. So we'll take a break on that, and we'll be back more with Trey Zoller from Jefferson's Bourbon.
And this one's called Don't Marry Mermaids by Mamarazzi. We'll be right back.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels, to lower barrel entry proof before heat-cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's Cost Be Damned Taste Is Everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
All right, and we are back on In the Drink here with Trey Zoller from Jefferson's Bourbon. And during the break, Trey poured me a little bit of his brand new release, the Groth Reserve Cask Finish, which I have in my mason jar right here. It smells awesome. You definitely get that kind of vinous, winey flavor to it. Winey in a good way, not in a bad way.
Right. Yeah, this was a lot of fun. When I'm not drinking bourbon, I like big Cabernets. And I was turned on to Groth Cabernet a few years ago and really, really liked it. I had a friend, a colleague that knew the winemaker out there. And he was able to, he asked them if we could have some of the barrels that they were taking out of rotation. So typically these barrels, French oak barrels, housed and aged the Groth Reserve for a couple years. They sent us the barrels, wet barrels, that I put in what I call hot boxes, which are nothing more than containers that we put out in the distillery yard to really sweat the bourbon out of the barrel. And or sweat the wine out of the barrel. So we filled these barrels with the bourbon, put them in the hot boxes in June, and kept it in there for 10 months. At first, it sweat the wine out so much, it really was separate. It almost tasted like having a glass of Cabernet and then a shot of bourbon on the back end. And over the months, it really melded well together and balanced out. So today, what you have is, you know, you're able to pick up these flavors, again, that you don't get typically in bourbon. A lot of black cherry, a lot of blackberry flavors that really come out, and it just kind of explodes with flavor.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. And I have to admit that I am not a big Cabernet drinker. And so I saw this and was like, not that, you know, not that excited about, you know, about the prospect, but it kind of melds so well. The flavors are so complementary, and this product is delicious. This is really an easy to love bourbon, even at, you know, 10 in the morning.
Right. I thought so as well. And typically, we experiment with a barrel or two when we're looking at doing something. We got 100 barrels from them, and it took them out there right away. And it actually peaked about 7 months. We kept it in there for 10 months. And it's really, as you said, it's a complement of flavors. Mm-hmm. And bourbon.
So it had to start its life in American oak. Is
correct.
That correct? You finish it in this French oak.
It was Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey, aged in Kentucky in new charred white oak bourbon barrels for 6 and 7 years prior to bringing in the Groth barrels and finishing it off there.
Now, I mean, I probably should have started the show with this, but it kind of leads into another question. So, what is bourbon? Bourbon is a distilled product that is made from 51% corn, aged in, as you said, heavily charred new American white oak barrels. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people think that even people who, you know, work for me when I do training say, where is bourbon made? And they say it has to be made in Kentucky. And that's not the case at all, right?
Not the case at all.
Bourbon can be made anywhere in America. And we're seeing certainly in New York and other parts of the country as well, people releasing these kind of new bourbons. Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts on this movement for these kind of small distilleries to release bourbons that certainly don't have the kind of age characteristics that yours do?
And I think that's kind of the problem. I think a number of these distilleries are going to produce wonderful whiskeys, but they need time in the wood. And there's no shortcut for that. You know, even our Ocean that really accelerates the aging process, as we saw the first time as we put it in new charred white or put new fill in. Now we're putting 6 to 8 year old bourbon in it. I don't want to shortcut it. That's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to take any shortcuts. And you can't with bourbon. It needs time in the wood. And I think some of these new distilleries, craft distilleries are popping up, are going to have fantastic whiskey, but they've got to have the patience to let it age properly to get there.
Do you feel like there's a minimum amount of time that you should be able, you should, by law, it's only like 2 or 3 years, right?
Correct. If it's under 4 years, you have to put it on the label, but it's got to be over 2 years. You know, most of your bottom shelf Kentucky bourbons from the big guys are at least 4 years old. And I would put that 4 year old bourbon made by the big guys in Kentucky against almost any craft distiller that has younger bourbon out there. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the craft guys that have bourbon that's aged older than that, phenomenal whiskey, and it's going to be even, you know, they're going to be fantastic. But it needs proper time in the wood. You know, as I said earlier, most distillers will say 70 to 80% of what bourbon is comes from the maturation process. It gives it its heart and soul. It gives it, that's what bourbon is. So once it has time there, they're going to make some great products, and I'm all for it.
So obviously, you know, this Ocean project has been it seems like it's been a successful one, but it's opened your eyes to maybe other ways of aging bourbon. Do you believe in any way of maybe accelerating the process? Are you working with temperatures even at, you know, even at the aging room?
I am experimenting with different environment and agitations for the maturation process. Mm-hmm. Not so much to accelerate it, because everything that we're putting out right now is at a minimum of 6 years, 6 to 30 years. I think the environment and agitation makes a big difference. And you know, it helps that my dad writes a book on bourbon history and looking back at it. But the reason that bourbon was aged in Kentucky in the manner that it's aged in is practicality. You know, you've got a distillery, you're going to age it right next to it. It's expensive to transport it. And that's what was interesting about the Ocean Project. You know, when people started distilling on the western slope of the Appalachians, nobody was aging whiskey at that time. A barrel was a very expensive item, and it was the only thing that they had to transport the whiskey. So when they started taking the bourbon to market by floating it down the rivers and then putting it on ships in New Orleans and sailing it up, it had the time to age for the first time. And it was aging like we age the ocean, where it rocks back and forth on the water. So I think people in New York and Philadelphia and Boston, when they got that Kentucky bourbon that had aged on the water, that's why they were saying, I want that bourbon from Kentucky. So, as you said, bourbon can be made elsewhere, and they're making good bourbon elsewhere. Just needs time to properly age. Now, will there be other environments that seem to be better placed to age bourbon? Maybe. I don't know.
Wow.
Time will tell.
So, presumably, New Yorkers were drinking better bourbon than those down in Kentucky at that time.
Back then? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, they weren't aging it that long in Kentucky at the time, and it certainly didn't have time on the water, and then it didn't go around the streets of Florida and have that sun baking on it. So, yeah, I think so.
Yeah. What are some of the pressing issues that you talk about with the other distillers when you get together? Is there something that's really kind of top of the mind for everyone at this time?
Well, we've had issues, believe it or not, in our supply chain. Just the cooperages, the barrels, are a big shortage of barrels right now because the bourbon industry has exploded. And in the last several years, all the large distilleries have at least doubled in their capacity to produce, and all the micros that have popped up, the cooperages can't keep up. The last couple of winters have been very harsh winters, a lot of snow, and there's not enough loggers to get into the woods to pull out enough wood that needs to be cured afterwards. So there's actually been kind of a shortage in the supply chain just from the barrels. And then, you know, it's trying to keep up with demand. Domestically, bourbon has exploded, and it's doing that across the world as well. So, you know, throughout bourbon's history, there's been a cycle of boom and bust. And the bust, typically, there's a reason for it. Prohibition. World War II, we had to stop production at the time. In the 70s, people started going to, you know, different types of products, and McDonald's exploded and soft drinks and things like that. So, yeah, actually, I flew up to D.C. and our mayor sat next to me the other day, and he asked me, you know, where I thought we were in this bourbon renaissance. And you know, we put it into football terms. So he said probably the end of the first quarter, going into the second quarter. I think it's got a long way to go.
Wow. And then what do you think, you know, we'll end on this question, but what do you think's coming up in that second quarter before halftime?
You know, as as there's been so much information, and as we've said, the bourbon consumer has become much more educated. You know, when we've launched the Ocean and the Groth and a number of, we're just about to launch our bourbon or our wood experimental project. If I would have done that 5 years ago, no one would care. Now that consumer has such a thirst for what else is out there and what can be done to help. You know, I'm trying to respect the heritage of what bourbon is and the six laws that protect the integrity of it, but push the boundaries of it without bastardizing. And I think where we're going to go is we're going to see people working with different finishes and how we can look at the environment of where we're aging it to bring different flavors mm-hmm. into it. Organically, not flavoring it with outside sources, but what we can do with the wood to give different flavors.
Sounds fascinating. Sign me up. Something that I'd be super interested in is maybe if there was an historical bourbon that maybe one that your dad was particularly excited about and kind of reviving a very old recipe, maybe even in the days before bourbon was filtered. I think that would be super interesting for people to try, especially when you have all that research at your hands.
Sounds like the next project's on the books now.
All right. Trey, thank you so much for being on In the Drink. I love Jefferson's bourbon, and I continue to love it, and you can certainly find it at all of our restaurants. And that Ocean we have at Alta Linea, so excited to pour it there.
Beautiful. Thanks a lot for having me, Joe. Thanks for supporting us.
And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.